This is Rusty Tanton, and you're listening to Politics is Vocal on the Georgia Podcast Network. The date is August 2nd, 2006. Tonight, Amber Ray and I attended a book signing at Manuel's Tavern featuring author David Sirota. What you're about to hear is Sirota's opening remarks and a question and answer session with the crowd.
Good evening, everyone. How y'all doing? Good. That was pretty responsive. My name is Tim Carroll. I'm president of Georgia for Democracy. I'd like to thank you again for all for coming out. We're very, very happy to have David Sirota with us. Catherine contacted David a few months ago and asked him if he would put us down for a tour. We could have him in town, and he was gracious enough to come and speak with us. We also have an event tomorrow night if you're interested in doing a quiet evening dinner. It is a fundraiser for Georgia for Democracy, help fund our events. You can see Catherine or myself afterwards, and we'll be glad to hook you up with that. I believe the cost is $75, and David Sirota will be there. So, without further ado, I want to bring up the author of Hostile Takeover. If you all please welcome David Sirota.
Thank you. This is my second time to Atlanta, and the second stop, the second city on my tour in the South. And I will tell you what I told the other group I met with when I was in Kentucky. I said, if humidity could fuel cars, Georgia would be Saudi Arabia. I moved to Montana from living on the East Coast most of my life, and you know, I never really realized that you can have heat without humidity. And I'll tell you something. I encourage all of you at some point to check out Montana. It's quite a state, although I wouldn't claim that I'm from there. Note to, if any of you ever move there, never tell anybody you're from Montana unless you're a ninth generation Montanan. Otherwise, be ready to sort of defend yourself. I want to thank Georgia for Democracy for inviting me. I was thrilled to be invited to come down here and talk about my book. As I told the Young Democrats of Atlanta in there, you know, I think there's a lot of people who feel a bit helpless right now. We're all feeling pretty disgusted with a lot of what the Republicans are doing right now. But, you know, the cliche really does stand right now, that oftentimes it's darkest right before the dawn. And as I travel around the country and I meet with so many different groups, it's very obvious to me that there is a real movement being built around this country. A movement that I think starts to see the Democratic Party as conservatives see the Republican Party. And that's important. Conservatives, as Bill Bennett, our former wonderful education secretary, told a recent conference, conservatives see the Republican Party as a means to an end. And I think progressives are starting to see the Democratic Party as a means to an end. And I think that's good for two reasons. I think that's good for progressives and the progressive agenda. And I think that's good for the Democratic Party and the Democratic Party's ability to succeed in the electoral arena. Republicans right now understand the value of having motivated, principled, ideological conservatives fueling their party, going into battle on behalf of their party. And I think for too long, Democrats have seen the party as an ends and not a means, and furthermore, have not valued having an ideological, principled movement pushing their party. Tom DeLay, when he was majority leader of the House, as I learned when I worked in the House, Tom DeLay valued the conservative movement that existed outside of the Republican Party apparatus in Washington, because that conservative movement made it easier for him to corral the votes necessary to pass the legislation he wanted to pass. And I think only now are Democrats becoming more comfortable, although not fully comfortable, but more comfortable with an actual progressive movement that helps the Democratic leadership pass things or stop things and keep unified. So I would encourage all of you, and I think by virtue of the fact that you're here, you understand this, but I would encourage all of you to see yourselves as part of a movement, because that ultimately is going to be what is responsible for taking this country back. Now, that begs a question. What is the movement really all about? And obviously, any successful movement in American history has different people coming to the table for different reasons. But there are core principles. And what I try to lay out in my book, Hostile Takeover, as a basis for this movement, is the idea that our government no longer represents us. In fact, our government no longer even pretends to represent us. In fact, I'll go even further, that not representing us is hardwired into the system. That it's actually difficult for even the best politicians to try to represent us because of what the system is set up as. And specifically, what is the system set up as? The system is set up for good people who want to run for office. It forces them to rely on big money. Money that comes into their campaign coffers, not altruistically, but with the expectation of a payback of legislative favors. That means that corruption, that not representing us, ordinary citizens who can't pay up to that political table, are not represented. And as my book shows on specifically each of the core economic issues, we can see how the political incentive in the political arena is to sell us out. Now, a lot of the debate is all about divisive social issues. That's not an accident. For big money interests, what big money interests want is the least political issues, I think, that should be least political. Issues of spirituality, privacy. These big money interests want to take center stage. The issues that big money interests want depoliticized, of course, are the issues that our government can actually affect, economic issues. But if those issues are depoliticized, that means big money interests won't be challenged. Those are the issues that those with money don't want to talk about. Let me give some specifics. 60 to 70% of Americans have consistently told pollsters that they support and want a universal government-guaranteed, government-sponsored healthcare system. That is a fact, period. A fact. In fact, last year, the Pew Research Organization did a study just of the hardcore Republican base, just of the 30% of Americans who are the hardcore Republican base. Half of the hardcore Republican base in this country says they support a universal government-sponsored, government-guaranteed healthcare system paid for by tax increases. That's not talked about in the political debate. Single-payer healthcare, not talked about in the political debate. It's depoliticized. No, we can't talk about that. That's crazy talk. That's crazy. That's kooky. Anybody who brings that up is crazy. Well, 60 to 70% of Americans must be crazy. That silence in the political debate, juxtaposed with the vast majority of Americans who want that policy, shows you that there is a hostile takeover. The hostile takeover means that there is silence on that issue. We can go to any other issue that we want. I'll give you another example. Job outsourcing. 80 to 90% of Americans tell pollsters they think that they're worried about job outsourcing and that our government, at the very least, should not actively use taxpayer resources to help companies ship out American jobs. You don't hear much about that. What you hear, of course, in 2004 is an official White House report endorsing job outsourcing as good for the economy. You hear that the Commerce Department, with your taxpayer dollars, are holding events across the country encouraging companies to move their operations to China. You hear of an agency called the Export-Import Bank, funded by tens of billions of dollars of your taxpayer money, which subsidize companies that ship jobs overseas. You hear about an amendment brought forward by courageous Democrats and a few Republicans to say no subsidies should go to companies that are simultaneously increasing their foreign workforce and decreasing their American workforce. That was voted down. That is the hostile takeover of our government. That is our government not behaving on behalf of ordinary citizens. That is our government selling us out. Now, I want to be clear. I think a lot of anger in many cases is directed, and I would say misdirected, solely at corporations. My take is this. A corporation has to do everything it can to make as much money as possible, period. Executives have a fiduciary responsibility to make as much money as possible, whether they run roughshod over your life or mine or not. I hear some people say, oh, well, that's a good corp. They're a nice corporation. They're very nice. They're good corporate citizen. They're good to the environment. They aired nice ads telling us how great they are. Make no mistake about it. Everything a company does is designed to make money. They air the ad telling you how nice they are, so you think they're nice and you go buy their product. And let me be clear, there's nothing wrong with that. There is nothing wrong with that. The problem is when you have a government that doesn't confine that unbridled profit motive to make sure it doesn't run roughshod over all of us. There used to be a time in this country where the government was at least a better, more fair arbiter between the corporate profit motive and the rest of society. The problem is that big money interests understood that the way to really get what they want would be to make the government complicit in, exclusively in, the profit motive. Now, I know I'm speaking to an audience of Democrats here, and remember, I consider myself a Democrat. I work for Democrats. I've helped elect Democrats in red states. But I want to be clear. Don't fool yourself and think that the Democratic Party is entirely guilt-free here. Big money interests understood and figured out about 20, 25 years ago that if we can buy just enough of a piece of the Democratic Party to be complicit in all of this, then the entire debate shifts radically. So let's look at the bankruptcy bill which recently passed last year. This is a bill that simultaneously gutted consumer bankruptcy protections and expanded bankruptcy protections for the super rich. Now, when I say that to some audiences, you know, it's like, come on, that's hyperbolic. You know, that's you're over the top. One example: the same bill that gutted your consumer bankruptcy protections, your Chapter 11 bankruptcy protections, included a line that expanded bankruptcy protections for people who have more than $2 million worth of business debts. Let's understand what that means. So you can go tens of thousands of dollars into debt because of skyrocketing healthcare bills, but if you're a corporate executive and you rip off tens of millions of dollars from your shareholders, your workers, and your retirees, no, you get the old bankruptcy. You get the previous ones. You get expanded bankruptcy protections. In fact, you get a special provision that allows you to go buy a $25 million mansion, and it says that the government can't go after your mansion because you stashed the money, the equity, in your mansion. That bill that did that passed with all Republicans and half of the Democrats in Congress. And the Democrats were some of the worst in peddling the justification for this bill. Because, of course, they don't come and say, listen, we want to pass a bill to expand, you know, bankruptcy protections for the super rich who paid to get a seat at the table, and we want to cut bankruptcy protections for ordinary citizens. No, what they say is that we need bankruptcy, quote-unquote, reform to crack down on irresponsible people. Sort of an update of the Reagan welfare queen language. You know, lazy slobs are violating or abusing bankruptcy laws. We got to crack down on these irresponsible people. Senator Evan Bayh, he was one of them who kept saying this. Irresponsible people. You know, I think the quote was, and I don't have the book in front of me, but I have it in my book. It says, you know, we can't ask ordinary citizens to pay or bear the burden of the irresponsible decisions of irresponsible people when it comes to bankruptcy. What's not said is that 80 to 90% of bankruptcies in this country are caused by medical debt, a death in the family, or a loss of a job. That's what's really going on. What's not said is that the credit card industry last year made $24 billion on penalty fees alone. That's not enough money for them. They want to make more. So they bought the laws that will now allow them to make more. Amendments were brought forward on this bill. For instance, an amendment was brought forward by Bill Nelson, a Democrat from Florida, that said, if you're forced into bankruptcy because your identity is stolen, you get the old previous stronger bankruptcy protections. He introduced that amendment the week after Bank One lost 1 million people's information. That bill was voted down. Understand what that means. Your bank now can lose your financial information. Your identity can be stolen. Your credit can be destroyed. You can be forced into bankruptcy. And that same bank can use the fact that you are now in bankruptcy as a justification to charge you higher interest rates. Another amendment was brought forward that said, soldiers who go to Iraq, National Guardsmen who were drafted to go to Iraq, if they are forced into bankruptcy because the National Guard pays them substantially less from the job that they were working here at home, they get to temporarily keep the old bankruptcy reform, bankruptcy measures, the better protections, voted down. I'm not kidding. This is in my book. You can look it up. What this should say to you is that we have a government solely focused on making sure that the lobbyists and the executives who pay to get a seat at the table are enriched by public policy. To call it public policy is to insult the public, because what it is private policy being made in the public's name. Now, how do we take the government back? You know, this is the subtitle of my book, How We Take It Back. And, you know, I said, you know, if I wrote this book 10 years from now, it would just be How Big Money and Corruption Conquered Our Government, period. Goodbye. Thank you very much. Because I do think we are really standing at the precipice here. I mean, we are living through a slow-motion Great Depression. The Great Depression was marked by, you know, it was a very steep decline. But all you got to do is open the business section of any major paper in this country and know that something fundamental is going on, fundamentally bad. How we take it back. You know, I think people want, you know, some magic formula, you know, boil an egg, you know, say a couple magic words, you know, turn around, abracadabra, boom, the hostile takeover is over. It's just not going to be that easy. The hostile takeover took probably 30, 35 years to accomplish. It's going to take, in my estimation, at least half that. And so if we accept that, then we have to accept that the first step is to focus our activism way more locally than I think people are necessarily inclined to. And I don't blame people for that. Every time you turn on the television, it's, you know, George Bush sneezed, George Bush did this, George Bush, George Bush, George Bush. Now, it's not that George Bush is not important, but there's other stuff going on. I can make a very serious argument to you that, especially on the fundamental economic policies that affect everybody's daily lives, the state, local, and municipal level often has as profound impact on our lives as the national level. Now, why? You know, I think the media covers Bush more because it's, you know, media consolidation. It's cheaper to have four people covering the White House than it is to actually cover local news. But we have to resist that temptation for two reasons. First and foremost, you can have a far greater impact at the state, local, municipal level in actually affecting outcomes than you can as you go up the political food chain. The hostile takeover of the government is far less pronounced as you go down the political food chain. It doesn't not exist. But you put this many people in a room with your state legislators and you tell them, we want you to vote for X, Y, and Z, and if you don't, we're going to throw you out of office. That person might not change their vote, but they're certainly listening a lot harder than the officials higher on the political food chain. The second reason to continue to focus as locally as possible is that if you accept that the hostile takeover has taken a long time to perpetrate, you have to accept the fact that it's going to take a long time to recover. And you have to accept the fact that today's county commissioners, state legislators, today's dog catchers are tomorrow's congressmen, senators, governors, and presidents. We've got to get to these people now and let them know that they will be rewarded for a politics that stands up for us and that their political careers will be cut short if they sell us out. Last thing I would say, in our local political activism, I would urge all of you to consider being involved in trying to get some form of public financing of elections, either in this state, in your county, in your municipality. You know, there's a Supreme Court ruling that says money is speech. It's a controversial decision. It's a very complicated paradigm. I'm more interested in the short term than the long term in terms of challenging the legality of that basis. And by that, I mean you're not going to be able to fully cut off money out of politics. Anybody who tells you you can eliminate the influence of money on politics, what you should say to them is you're crazy. Okay? Money is always going to play a role in politics. The issue is not just money. It's money entering the system with the expectations of legislative favors, often legislative favors directed for private, very, very narrow interests. We've got to create a funding stream, a resource stream for people who want to run for office, good people who need resources but want resources that don't come with that expectation. Public financing of elections, in my mind, is the best example of a way to fight money that comes into the system with the expectations of legislative favors with money that comes into the system that does not have those specific expectations. This is not a Republican or a Democratic idea. Democratic states like Maine, Connecticut have passed it. Very Republican states like Arizona have passed public financing of elections. This is something that needs to happen. It's not going to happen, in my estimation, at the federal level until it starts happening in more and more states. California's got a giant ballot initiative. Other states need to move forward on this. So when you're talking to folks, when you're working with people at the local level, put this in their mind. And remember, it doesn't just have to be a statewide issue. You can do public financing of municipal elections. New York City, public financing of municipal elections. Portland, Oregon, public financing of municipal elections. Other municipalities have partial public financing of elections. And I know the argument. Oh, we're going to give money to politicians. Oh, welfare for politicians. Well, how much money do you think we're wasting right now on a system that demands the legislative favors? I worked on the House Appropriations Committee. I can tell you tens of billions of dollars are wasted every year at the behest of a lobbyist whispering in a congressman's ear saying, I want you to approve this contract in exchange for this, essentially in relation to the contract, this pittance of a campaign contribution. It is an investment strategy. There's a stat in my book that talks about in Ohio, the business leaders that contributed about $1.4 million to President Bush's campaign received $3 billion in government contracts subsequent to those donations, many including no-bid contracts. It's an investment strategy. We are losing money right now because we have this system. So a public financing system of election is ultimately a way to invest in our democracy and save money. So listen, I want to thank all of you for having me. I really appreciate it. The humidity is an experience. No, I'm kidding. But I really want to thank all of you for your activism and for your being involved in your community. It's absolutely critical. Do not get depressed. Things are going to change. Things are changing. And just thank you very much for your energy and your enthusiasm. I'll take some questions. Or we have questions. Sorry. We've been collecting questions.
Okay, we'll start with this one. In your opinion, what are the chances of a national health care plan being a plank in one or even both 2008 presidential tickets? Further, if it is on one or both, do you think it will be a fully government-managed plan or outsourced to put insurance to insurance companies?
My answer to that is that I think that at least on the Democratic Party platform, I would expect some language that calls for a universal health care system. I do not think, at least not yet, although I would love to think that it was going to happen, that there would be a specific call for a specific program. I definitely don't think that we're at the point yet where the Democratic Party's official position will be a single-payer health care system. And let's be clear, a single-payer health care system is not necessarily one that does not have a private element. That is to say, when I worked for in Congress or for, you know, on Capitol Hill, the way it worked was the government was the payer, the insurance company was the administrator. Now, certainly there's some waste in there, but there also is competition. The insurance companies essentially were competing for the federal patient, the customer essentially. The government was paying for it. So I think there are hybrid models where the government is the payer, but the private, there is some private, or at least not private, but not-for-profit private entities operating there, which, in fairness, there has been some benefit to the private system. I mean, my book talks about, you know, we have the best healthcare system in the world. We hear that all the time. Well, we got the best healthcare system in the world, certainly for people who can pay for it. We don't have the best healthcare system in the world for people who can't pay for it. But in terms of innovations, you know, I think the private system has created some benefits. So the final point I'll make on that is I think we have to look a little bit farther. I think by 2012, we will be at a point where we can really expect single-payer healthcare system to really be a part of the plank of the platform. I think 2008 is a bridge step, but I think by 2012 we'll be at a point where people are basically going to say it is an absolute embarrassment that our country is the only country in the industrialized world to not have a system like this, and furthermore, that I think there will be a critical mass, frankly, of big money, of corporations that we're going to say we can't pay for these healthcare costs. And essentially one set of corporations is going to gang up against another set of corporations, the everybody versus the health insurance profiteers, and that's when we'll get what we want.
Okay. Many questions about public funding of you know, public financing of elections, but this is sort of an overview of the whole issue. It's a little bit long. I apologize. Oh, sorry. Considering that ultimately money has and does translate into the marketing muscle, how does the progressive movement, in which the primary objective is not making money but social progress, gain marketing equality with the corporate conservatives?
Can you repeat the beginning of the question?
Considering that ultimately money has and does translate into marketing muscle, how does the progressive movement, in which the primary objective is not making money but social progress, gain marketing equality?
That's a good question. I think let me unpack the question a little bit. It sounds to me like the question is, look, you know, conservatives, many of the conservative donors have a personal financial motive to donate to conservative causes because it will enrich them. You know, it's the personal motive meets the political motive, or really the personal motive is the political motive. So how do we create a movement that's essentially based on economic equality. And economic equality, as we know, I guess financially, in terms of bottom line, can often be a little bit more threatening to those with resources. It's a good question. My answer is threefold. First and foremost, I think that there are progressive donors out there who have resources, who are willing to invest in movements bigger than their own personal financial interest. But obviously, a movement can't be based or fully funded by that. Second, I think that we need to all, as I say in my book, become more and more comfortable donating to political causes ourselves in small dollar figures. That I think it needs to become, donating to a political campaign needs to become like when you go to, you know, your house of worship and the basket comes around, sort of an obligation. Without a public financing system, we have to see investing in our political system as really a civic obligation. You know, the one thing, one of the things that the internet has done is it's brought in a lot more small dollar donors who come to the table not with personal, that is very specific, narrow interests. You know, give me this contract. It's more of a, it's an interest in terms of a broad agenda. So I think that's good. Finally, I think that the way to do it is to try to start rebuilding and expand some of our small d democratic institutions. In specific, I'm talking about the labor movement. The labor movement was and is one of the last small d democratic movements in this country. That is to say, people, the way that it operates, not a corporation. A corporation is essentially a private tyranny. Okay, it's a dictatorship. The labor movement, a union, by and large, still elects its leadership with votes. Now, you know, there's sometimes corruption there. There's certainly a lot less corruption in unions than there is in corporate America. It's not a perfect institution. Point being, though, when you have mass small d democratic institutions, you have a mass funding source where the goal of political funding, of public policy, is for a broad amount of people and not a narrow amount of people.
Okay. Related to that is, how do candidates get elected? How do they get the money to get elected if they're not taking it from corporations or...
That's another good question. I mean, it is a chicken and the egg question. You know, how do you get elected without taking, you know, without relying on big money? Well, I have two answers to that. One is that not everybody in this system is bad. My book, every chapter has a story or a couple stories of people who are in the system and fighting the good fight. So I don't think you're necessarily automatically complicit, because it's a system that largely forces you to be in the system, partake in this system. That said, I think there are inspirational examples not only on people who are fighting the good fight, but people who are actually trying to pioneer a new way to raise money in lieu of a public financing system. Look, the guy I used to work for, Bernie Sanders, he gets a huge amount of money from very, very small dollar donors. That didn't just happen overnight. He has worked and worked and worked to cultivate a grassroots organization, regardless of fundraising, and a grassroots fundraising base. I guess what I'm saying is that if you're really serious about not being part of the big money system, it's possible, but it's not instant gratification. The big money system is an instant gratification system. The easiest path to being elected is to essentially just become complicit in it all. And ultimately, the reason I want to see public financing is because I want to see a system where the easiest thing to do is not sell out. Right now, the easiest thing to do is sell out. The exceptions are the people like Bernie Sanders who have not taken the path of least resistance. Ultimately, if we're going to change the system, we've got to make the path of least resistance the path to not selling out. In light of that, though, I don't think it's hopeless. I don't think it's a zero-sum game. You either sell out or you don't. I think there are ways to raise money from small-dollar donors, especially with the internet. And there are ways that even if, you raise most of your money from small-dollar donors and you have to make compromises here and there on who you raise money from, there are still ways to be good legislators as long as you have public pressure on you.
What do you think of the recent Arizona proposal to encourage voter participation by putting people who vote into a pool for lottery excess funds? I had never heard about this.
This was I think I've heard about this. This is the if you go to vote, you might win a jackpot. Yeah. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think that any way to get more people to the polls is a good thing, as long as I forget how much they're putting up there. I think that's $1 million. I mean, I guess ultimately we want to get to a situation where it's 100% voter participation. But I think that the problem is not really compelling people to vote, right? I think the problem is we've got to give people a reason that they want to vote. If the only reason that people want to vote is that they think they're going to win $1 million, you haven't really solved the problem. The reason people don't really want to vote is because people perceive neither party as really standing up for them, and even more broadly, that the entire political process has sold them out. So ultimately, the real way to solve this disease afflicting democracy is to show people, starting from the ground up, that their vote actually matters, but it's not. I don't want to make it sound so altruistic. Not that their vote actually matters, but that the decisions based on votes in general matter to ordinary people's lives.
Okay, just a couple more questions. I'm sure you're aware that in Georgia we have a couple of these flat tax guys, and so a couple people asked what you think about that.
Yes, this is a topic I cover in my book pretty extensively. Don't make any mistake about it. A flat tax is a massive tax increase on ordinary Americans. And you don't have to believe me. You should believe Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan's people went to testify before Congress when Republicans in the 80s were pushing a flat tax. And Ronald Reagan's Treasury Department said just what I said. It would be a massive tax increase on ordinary citizens. This was brought up again in the 1990s, Dick Armey. He brought up a flat tax. Again, tax experts from both sides of the aisle were brought to testify before Congress, a massive tax increase on ordinary Americans. So my response is, when somebody says a flat tax, all you need to say, if somebody, unless they're a millionaire, if the average person walks up and you said, look, I'm for a flat tax, you say, I didn't know you're for raising your own taxes. That's really interesting. You should tell them that. I mean, and I think that people, now, it does cut to a question, maybe people like with the estate tax, there's this issue where some people understand that it only affects 1% of the population, but they don't like the concept of a death tax. And so there is the question of, are people opposed to the concept of a progressive tax structure? And even though it would be a massive tax increase for ordinary people, do they just like that concept? Well, that's a tougher issue. I bet you that 75% of the people you talk to who are for a flat tax, if you simply tell them it would be a massive tax increase for themselves, they'd say, okay, I'm out. I'm not into that anymore, if you really explain to them. The other 25% who don't like the concept of a progressive tax system, I'm not sure you can negotiate with those people. But I would say this. I would just repeat what Warren Buffett said. Warren Buffett famously said a couple years ago, there's something wrong with the tax system that taxes me at the same or lower rate than it taxes my secretary. And if Warren Buffett can go on record and say that, then I think that most Americans should be able to say the same thing.
Okay. This is a double question. How would a defeat of Lieberman and affect the national parties and the system of corporate patronage you describe? And was reading in the Washington Post today about a divide between the DCCC and Howard Dean. Do you understand what that is all about? So I guess this is a Democratic Party question.
With the Lieberman question, I think as long as Ned Lamont gets above about 40%, I think the battle has been won in a certain extent. If Ned Lamont gets blown out in the Lieberman race, then I don't think anything's really happened. Ned Lamont gets over 40%, what it says is Democratic incumbents everywhere need to worry about being accountable to the party they purport to represent. No Democratic incumbent in this country wants to face a Democratic primary, even if it's a 40% Democratic primary. If Ned Lamont wins, it just sends that message far more intensely. It says not only do you have to worry about dealing with sort of a nuisance of a primary, you got to be worried you're going to lose your job. I think that is the best thing to happen to small d democracy in a long time, that these politicians really do believe that these Senate and House seats are their property, and God damn it, how dare anybody think they should try to take it away. We will get a government that's more accountable to us, even if just that fear is in their head that, hey, maybe this isn't my property. That is a good thing way beyond Connecticut. I think the national media has missed that completely. They see this as left versus right. What this really is a division between power, people who have power, think power is their property, and the vast majority of citizens who both parties have locked out of power. This is why every national pundit, almost to a T, has decried the outrage of Joe Lieberman, such a wonderful person, being challenged. Forget about the fact that it's Connecticut's Senate seat. It's not Joe Lieberman's Senate seat. It's Connecticut's Senate seat. How could people dare to challenge such a nice man as Joe Lieberman? And what that says is the national pundits and the national political establishment is afraid and does not want to deal with a political system where ordinary people have the nerve to demand that elected officials and the seats that they hold are accountable to them. And so I think, ultimately, as I said before, if Ned Lamont gets over 40%, it's a major victory. The message has been sent. If he wins, an even bigger message has been sent. On the Howard Dean DCCC thing, that is a debate, as I understand it, between Howard Dean, who wants to invest more of the Democratic Party's resources on a multi-year basis in all 50 states, rather than what it happens usually, where it's every 2 years they pick the 30 or so House districts to invest in, and they only invest there. I stand with Howard Dean. I stand with Howard Dean because I live in Montana, and I worked on a campaign, for instance, in Montana. If we had even a little bit of resources in a sustained basis from the National Party, and we got it at the end, but on a sustained basis in, say, 2000, when Brian Schweitzer ran against Conrad Burns as a first-time candidate against a two-term incumbent senator and lost by 2.5 points, had we had even a little bit of sustained resources, we probably would have won that race. I think Howard Dean has a long-term vision, or at least the strategy he is pursuing is a long-term strategy. The DCCC is pursuing a 50+0.1% strategy. Now, I don't frankly blame either side. Rahm Emanuel, who I have a lot of problems with, who's been a major problem in selling out the Democratic Party on economic issue after economic issue, as chairman of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, it is true. His goal is to win this year's election. That's his job. Howard Dean's job is to take a little bit of a longer view. How do I make the Democratic Party win for the long haul rather than just this year? And frankly, those two goals are coming into a bit of conflict. I would rather see a Democratic Party that's in the majority for 40 years than a Democratic Party that wins the House for 2 years and then is in the minority for 40 years. And I think that Howard Dean is going to take a lot of flack for that, and I think he deserves a lot of credit for it because it takes a lot of courage to do what he's doing.
Thank you very much for answering all these questions. I want to take a moment to thank Acapella Books, who's over here in the corner selling David's book. And he will sign them. We'll have a little queue for signing the books after we finish here. And Georgia for Democracy would like to present you with a little bag of goodies with our name all over them. You know, that's the job. Thank you to everyone who came tonight. If you're interested in learning more about Georgia for Democracy and signing up for future activities like this, we have a sign-up sheet up here, or there's little business cards around on the tables. You could sign up online, and we'd be happy to take your email address. We send about 3 or 4 emails a month. We don't do a lot of fundraising, so it's not too bad. Thank you very much.
Thank you.